Well, who's up next but the human computer? That's right. Howard Bloom. We're going to be talking about the food crisis, the incredible oil prices, just through the mind of Howard Bloom. Well, Howard Bloom is the founder of the International Paleo Psychology Project and the Big Bang Tango Media Lab. In addition, founding board member of the Epic of Evolution Society and the Darwin Project. He's also a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and so many other organizations. The list is just too big to read. Howard Bloom. Hey, Howard, how are you?
George, hi. It's been a long time.
Always a pleasure, my friend. How you feeling?
You been?
I'm doing great. Today's my birthday, and I'm still
kicking. Oh, congratulations. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom. What's new with you?
Well, you know that among the other things that I've been doing over the last few weeks, about a few weeks ago, we all read in the papers about riots over food in Mexico, in Malaysia, in Egypt, and in Haiti. And there was a pattern to the headlines. They came on so fast, and they all blamed one thing. They all blamed biofuels. They all blamed ethanol. The fact that so many headlines came out simultaneously seemed a little suspicious. So I started digging around through some of my expert friends and asked a very simple question. What is the relationship between big oil and this spike in food prices? And the answer was, are you kidding? Every relationship in the world. And my friends in the ethanol and biofuels community started avalanching me with facts. Then I went out and did my own research, and it turns out that it not only substantiated their facts, it took their facts a good deal further. And it looks to me like we have been influenced by a snow job. You know, in Europe, these same headlines broke in Europe at the same time they broke in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the European Union had been considering a bill that would require that between 10% and 20% of the energy produced for the European Union by the year 2020 would be biofuels. All of a sudden, within the last couple of weeks, that came to a grinding halt, and the Green Party, the very party that you would think would be in favor of getting us all off of oil, was crying out that we had to stop taking food out of the mouths of starving children in Myanmar and other places of the sort. And that as a consequence, not only should this effort to increase the percentage of biofuels be rescinded, be utterly stopped, but that raising crops for biofuel production should be banned on every bit of farmland in the European Union. Well, as I said, it just seemed a little too convenient to be happening all simultaneously on its own.
And at the same time, we've looked at what's been going on over the past several months with oil. Absolutely out of control, Howard, isn't it?
It's bizarre. The price of oil a year ago was $55, a little bit less than $55 a barrel. The price of oil 2 weeks ago was over $133 a barrel. That's 2.5 times what it had been just the previous 12 months. It's insane, George.
And there's no shortage, Howard. They're tricking us.
Well, there is no shortage. And if you look at the capacity of Saudi Arabia, the two biggest oil-producing countries in the world are, and these will sound like relatively familiar countries because they're both been in the headlines a fair amount, Saudi Arabia, which has the capacity to produce, I think it's 10 million barrels a day, and Iran, which has the capacity to produce about 7 million barrels a day, and no other countries come even close. The nearest competitors produce about 2.5 million barrels a day.
Sure. Iraq could, but it's just not producing.
Well, yes, Iraq we know is seriously disabled at the moment, and we've been involved in the serious disablement, but nonetheless, there are the facts for you. The people who are cleaning up on this, and they really are cleaning up, are Saudi Arabia and Iran. And Iran doesn't have good things in store for you and me. On the other hand, and let's take a look and figure out where in the world this idea of a food shortage came from. First of all, was there a food shortage? And the answer is, well, in order to produce all the extra corn that was needed to make all the biofuels that were needed in the United States this year, we need, and worldwide, America needed to plant 11 million new acres of corn. Sounds like an awful lot, doesn't it?
It does, but this is a big, big country.
It's a big, big country, and the fact is that we planted 17 million new acres of corn. That means that we, or actually 18 million, and that means that we exceeded the amount we needed by about 50%. In other words, we had a surplus this year. So why are children starving in Cairo? Well, there was a shop owner in Cairo who was interviewed about this, and he was asked if indeed there was a food shortage, and he said, no, I've got more food than I can sell on my shelves. And he was asked, well, why can't you sell it? And he said, because it's doubled in cost over the course of the last year. Well, let's take a look at two different sneaky little factors here. What do you think is one of the biggest costs that goes into raising grain or food, especially, well, food that you grow in plants? It is oil.
And the fertilizer.
Yeah. Well, but remember, the biggest input to the fertilizer is fuel.
It's the oil. Yes.
It's oil. So when you take the price of oil, of fuel, and you 2.5 times it, you have just kicked way up the price, the costs of raising a bushel of grain. Now, there's another little factor. Farmers like to hedge their bets by buying futures. That is,
right.
Buying the it's too difficult to explain, but they want to buy what a bushel would cost a year from now.
Well, what they do is they will, for example, a farmer in Illinois, and I'm very familiar with some of them there, will harvest, let's say, his soybeans, okay?
Right.
He takes them to the grain elevator, and he stores them for a future date.
Right.
He doesn't just sell them right away.
Well, in this case, there's something interesting called commodities index funds. And it's a way of buying food that hasn't yet been harvested. And the total amount of commodities index funds, which are right now very, very, very popular, is $200 billion worldwide. Well, one little group cornered this market. It put $40 billion into commodities index futures, in other words, into buying up food, into driving up the price of food. And guess who this little player, this tiny little player that bought 20% of the entire commodities index market was?
Saudi Arabia.
It was OPEC.
Yep.
OPEC, gee, what do they make? Well, they make oil. What do you think that does to the price of food? Well, it drove the price of food up so high that major food processing companies like Archer Daniels Midland could not afford to buy food to process to send to your table and to mine. Does this help explain why people were having a difficult time feeding their children in Egypt and Malaysia and Mexico?
And how much money did they make on that commodities index?
Well, that is a figure that I do not have, but what I do have is a headline from Bloomberg's, and Bloomberg's is right now the leading financial service, that is financial information service in the world. And this is from 2 weeks ago, and it says, Wall Street grain hoarding brings farmers and consumers to near ruin. Now, they don't put the story together the way you and I are putting it together right now. All they say is that whoever it is that's investing in all of this stuff, and they don't name names, is driving the price so sky high that food companies can't afford to buy it, and as I said, send it to you and me in the form of cornflakes. But you and I both know who at least one of the big buyers is, the biggest of all, and that's OPEC. So now, meantime, you could say all of this is circumstantial evidence, and how can you prove it? Well, it turns out there's a little organization called the American Petroleum Institute, and it's been characterized by some as the biggest PR machine in the world, the biggest public relations machine in the world. And back in 1978, well, one historian of this says that there's been a battle between biofuels and oil-based fuels going on ever since the turn of the 19th century, around 1900. Because a guy named John David Rockefeller, who did a lot of good things that people don't normally know about, but John David Rockefeller was up against another source of fuel for a new thing called the automobile. And Rockefeller, in those days, wars between major corporations were very, very dirty affairs indeed. And Rockefeller threw all the dirt he could to make sure that this new gizmo would operate on oil. That new gizmo was the automobile. So there's been a long-standing battle, according to one historian of this, between biofuels, between alcohol, which is really what biofuels are, and gasoline. However, in 1978, the American Petroleum Institute came up with a very clever idea in case biofuels should ever threaten the monopoly of oil. And they called it their food versus fuel campaign.
Okay. And it sounds like we could be right in the middle of that.
Yes. Yes. It's taken them a long time to really get it off the ground, but they got it off the ground in roughly the last 2 months. And boy, once they got it off the ground, did it work. It worked incredibly well. So that's the overview. There are a lot of other little interesting details. I mean, there's 1.5 billion acres of farmable land in the United States, and only 70 million acres of it. Corn is not my favorite stuff to make biofuels out of by any stretch of the imagination, and it's not really the favorite stuff of most of the people who are advocating biofuels either. I mean, why take perfectly good corn and turn it into biofuels? Well, the fact is that only 70 million out of America's 1.5 billion acres are planted with corn to begin with. That's a really, really tiny sliver. And there's something else rather interesting. You know, we've heard a lot about how now that the standard of living is going up in China and India, the demand for meat, especially in China, has been going way up. And that means taking a lot more corn and feeding it to your cows and pigs, right?
Exactly.
Well, the fact is that cows and pigs can't digest starch. And when you run a whole mess of corn or soybeans or wheat or switchgrass, but especially corn, wheat, and soybeans, through an ethanol-producing plant, through a biofuels plant, the only thing that's really used to make biofuels is, guess what? The starch.
Mm-hmm.
And what's left over when you're finished, the waste material, is perfect stuff to send back to the farm because it's the ultimate animal feed. It is much better for animals, for farm animals, than corn is because the difficult-to-digest starch has been removed. And the result is that for every pound that you feed the animals of this stuff that's left over for making biofuels, you get 17% more weight on your farm animal. Well, that's more meat. So there hasn't really been a shortage of animal feed, far from it. In fact, it's just the opposite.
Why are they allowed to do this to us then, Howard?
Nobody's doing the snooping. You know that we've talked many times over these years about how the press is far lazier than it should be and is not used to doing any investigative reporting. And I haven't found any stories on this, George, anywhere, except in the there have been a few little hints, but nothing that puts together the big picture. In the pro-biofuels publications, and there are several pro-biofuels trade publications for people who are in the biofuels business, but even they haven't put all the facts together. Now, the first person I turn to when I ask this question is David Bloom. David Bloom is the author of a book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Any relation to Howard Bloom? Or he's B-L-U-M, isn't he?
Yeah, he's B-L-U-M-E, and he has a very different background from mine. He worked with, although we both have been involved with NASA, he worked with NASA a long time ago on alternative fuels and then spread out from there. I'm lost my train of thought, George.
Well, we were talking about how are they allowed to do this to
us? Well, he feels that the PR power of the oil industry is so humongous that nobody in the corporatized press of America will touch it. Now, I doubt that, George. You and I have talked, let's see, this is my 39th appearance on Coast to Coast.
Yep.
And if every once in a while I say something that somebody finds offensive and they try to get me off of Coast to Coast, that's happened. But the fact is they don't succeed. And we talk about the things that you feel are important, that I feel are important, that Art feels are important, and we say, to use vernacular language, screw it, to the people who are trying to stop us. And I think that's true of most of the media. You know, I've been involved with the press and with journalists now for something like almost 40 years.
It's been almost your entire career, hasn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I have not found that corporate powers are able to throttle stories. Not in major publications, certainly not in publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Coast to Coast, Coast to Coast Parent Company, But what does stop stories from appearing in headlines? Laziness. Most of the people that you and I know in the journalistic establishment can be bought for a good dinner. Most of them can be bought for a good trip. Take them somewhere for free, put them in an elegant hotel, feed them a lot of good food, and you have them. That isn't a problem if what they write about is valid. The difficulty is that it spoils them. It makes them accustomed to taking stories that are handouts, to taking press releases and printing them. And most of the people you and I know in the journalistic community would be offended by what I've said so profoundly that it's ridiculous.
But it's favoritism, and it happens.
Well, but they would say, I've never printed a press release. But think of the entire press corps in Washington. Everybody dies and kills to get into the press community in Washington. It is the elite prestige community of the entire journalism industry. Once you're there, you've made it. But what do you have to do in Washington in order to stay in Washington? You have to take press releases disguised as background press briefings from anonymous sources. But they're press conferences for all practical purposes. You have to take the press conference or the press handouts, the PR bulletins that are disguised as, well, these are unofficial papers and you're not supposed to have them, but so pretend you didn't get them from me. That's the way it's done in Washington. But if you don't print the things that you are given in your background briefings and that you are handed in these secret papers you were never supposed to be handed, you are banished from Washington. If you begin to do too many stories or even a small number of stories that bite the hands that feed you your press material, you are shut off from any press material whatsoever. You're no longer invited to the briefings. You are no longer handed the secret papers. You are no longer invited to the press conferences. And whoever employs you, whether it's CNN or NBC or ABC, removes you from Washington because you are spoiled goods. You are no longer useful as a journalist. In other words, to get along in Washington, you have to play along, and you have to not print the stories that are going to upset the people in the political establishment.
Just last night, Howard, we talked about our borders, and the thrust of the story wasn't illegal immigrants
right.
who are coming into this country. It was the incredible amount of drugs that were pushing these illegals into the country, many of whom are being used as mules
couriers,
to cart this stuff through.
Very, very interesting. Now, and of course, we know that there was a spate of stories over the course of the last 30 years, ever since the Vietnam War, about the extent to which the CIA has been using drugs, the extent to which it used drugs as currency in Southeast Asia, and God knows what's going on with drugs today. But it means that when you and I sit down with our journalist friends, and I do this all the time with my journalist friends, I encourage them to have courage. You know, the first two rules of science, my field, are what should be the first two rules of journalism. And the first of those rules is the truth at any price, including the price of your life. Have the courage to speak up for what you know is true, even if somebody threatens to silence you, even if somebody threatens to take your life. And I believe in that. And I believe that more journalists should believe in it too, and more publishers.
Howard, when we come back, I want to get your take on something. You know the way I love to throw curveballs at you.
Ah, yes.
Ed McMahon, his house could get foreclosed on. I mean, here's a guy that sat next to Johnny Carson. He's a dear friend of ours.
Right.
I want to get your take on what you think is going on out there, because I don't think people are doing well at all, and it's a facade. So we'll get your take when we come back. And phone calls with Howard Bloom. Hey, you might want to pick up the After Dark newsletter, where you get 13 issues for the price of 12. They come in full color, and they're fantastic stories. Call 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Howard Bloom. Howard, the foreclosure situation in this country is at an epidemic. What do you think is going on?
Well, first, I want to ask you, tell me the Ed McMahon story, and then I'll tell you what I think is happening.
Ed's got a $4.8 million house in Beverly Hills.
Right.
He's negotiating with his lender, a unit of Countrywide.
Right.
He apparently is behind in payments of well over $400,000
or $500,000. Wow. Wow.
I was told tonight one of the reasons for it, but I'm not going to say that.
Well, tell me what you think is going on, because I've got some statistics for you that pretty well seem to open the can of worms and show us the worms themselves. But I'm curious about how you analyze it.
I think that Americans were misled into getting these easy loans. They didn't have the money. Whenever you can flash a nice deal in front of somebody's eyes and they don't have a chance to investigate it, they're going to take it. And that's what they did.
And right. Then, and I saw another aspect of it, and that was I know somebody who has almost no income whatsoever. She earns about $10 an hour and only works about 20 hours a week. And I got to see the papers that she had signed with her mortgage company. And in her mortgage company, whoever was her mortgage broker claimed that she made five times as much as she makes, and gave a whole lot of other false information.
That's fraud.
And nobody checked it. Nobody checked it. You know how hard it was to get a mortgage 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago? You practically had to print applications on your grandmother's skin or something like that and turn your grandmother in.
True.
But that kind of checking hasn't been going on, apparently, over the last couple of years. But what else do you think is behind it? Because I have, again, a statistic for you.
I think the devalued dollar. I think the globalists who would like a one-world government want to put this country down on its knees, and there's a plan afoot to do that.
Well, once upon a time, there were a couple of very important phrases. One of them was American craftsmanship, another one was American ingenuity, and another one was thrift. All by itself, that little word alone, American thrift. And American thrift has disappeared. We went to a position, well, let me give you the overall figures. Our total debt now is a little bit over $9 trillion, and it's closing in on $10 trillion fast. Our annual gross domestic product is about $10 trillion. And approximately a year ago, our debt rose above our annual gross domestic product for the very first time ever. For the very first time ever. So we are spending ourselves into oblivion. And the only way to counterbalance that is to produce things that the rest of the world wants and to become what China, you know, China has been the biggest gross domestic exporter in the world for over 2,000 years. That's a long time. And China has a lot of American money sitting around in its slush funds. So does Saudi Arabia. Those are the two biggest holders of our debt. If they pulled the plug on us, we'd go down the tub and down the drain real, real fast. So we have to get into producing things the rest of the world wants and go back to American ingenuity. We have to have some thrift, and we have to have American ingenuity, and we have to have American workmanship again. The strange fact, George, is this, and this has been really surprising me. This has not come from reading. This has come from the people that I know. There are various people that I know who are in the business of putting venture capitalists together mm-hmm. with new industries. And you would think that right now things are so bad that venture capitalists wouldn't have money to put into new businesses.
But
that's not true. The venture capitalists are falling all over each other to put money into new things. And that is a hope for us. But also, and this is a guess, it also may be a sign that something is really wrong. Because we know that since 1973, the amount of money the average American worker has been making per hour, when you adjust it for inflation, has been going down. And we've had to first put women to work, so we had two-income families, and have really had a struggle and worked very hard. America is, no matter what other people might say about us being lazy, America is one of the hardest-working countries in the world. We work more hours per week than almost any other country.
And some people with more jobs, more hours they work than most people on this planet.
Right. So it's not that we're not hardworking people. We're very hardworking people. But look what happens when you start giving $15 million and $20 million packages to chief executive officers and then to all of the officers around them. Do they really, if they produce that value, if they really generate tens of thousands of jobs and keep the rest of us employed, it's worth it.
Sure.
But do they? And is the fact that there is so much money ready to go into venture capital a product of the fact that we're developing this vast imbalance and we are hollowing out the middle class? And we are shoving people, working people down toward the bottom, and we're moving people up on the top far, far higher than they deserve to go based on what they provide for the rest of us in terms of jobs and productivity.
To the phones we go. First time caller line, Terry in Delaware. You're on with Howard Bloom. Hi.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Hi.
I'm Tony from Wilmington, Delaware.
Hi, Terry.
Okay. What I want to put something out there for you, and once you're thinking on it. I've been feeling real uneasy about Obama running for office and actually going to win presidency. And I've been having a feeling, first of all, I don't sit around and think about things like this all the time. But what I'm feeling is that something of epic proportions, such as maybe a scandal or something like that, happens with him. And I'm not ruling out assassination either, but something like scandalous where he actually wins but does not get sworn in, actually, and has to step down and resign or something like that. And I feel that there'll be unrest with the racial aspect of the population, and therefore the government has to impose certain restrictions on us because they actually magnify the situation when it happens. And then as some of these ridiculous things they put on us, restrictions, they ease down on them to bring us out of it, and then just keep one or two of these imposes that were their actual main objective to begin with. And therefore, like such as, for example, they might say you can only travel certain times of the month or certain days of the month or something like that, just to, you know, move forward to the one more orders. And I like to know what you're thinking on that.
There's some people who say we may not even have an election. I don't think there's going to be a scandal to rock Barack Obama's campaign at all. Obviously everybody is concerned about any candidate's well-being, but Howard, I just don't see a scandal on the horizon. I think it'll be a close race.
I think that if Hillary and Bill could have come up with something, they would have, especially in the early days of the campaign when they still thought politics should be done the old way with smear campaigns. So I think you're right about that. And the difficulty is that this sounds like after 9/11, we know that we had the Patriot Acts and various acts that did cut down on our civil liberties. So it could happen again, conceivably, but let's hope it doesn't.
Next up, let's go to you, Don, in Oregon. It's your turn. Hey, Donald.
Hi, guys. I was kind of going on a different tangent there, but I'll go back to what you guys were talking about. It seems whoever they are, they're trying to break this country, like you were saying, Howard, to bring us to our knees. And I think once they do that with the, increasing the fuel prices, trying to the biofuel, which only gets 2/3 of what it costs, with gasoline or oil to produce that amount of fuel. And with the Monsanto companies like that making suicide seeds, it seems like they're trying to cull the population to where they can get us where they want us and select who they want. And, George, if you could give me back to Tommy, I'll listen off the air.
Okay, I will do that. Tom, he'd like to talk to you again after Howard's remarks. Go ahead, Howard.
Well, I'm just curious. And George, give me your feedback on this. Who do you think Donald is talking about?
They?
Yeah.
We've always wondered who they are.
Yes.
Howard, I think we're talking about elitists. I think we're talking about people above government, above corporations. I mean, they're the big bankers. They're the cartels up there who we don't really even hear a lot of who they are.
Right.
But they've got so much money and power, they don't know what to do with. And,
right.
You and I have talked about how they would like to reduce the world's population down to 500 million from the 6.5 billion.
Right. Those are the deep ecologists, and you're absolutely
they're
right.
They're out there. They're out there.
Right.
So I think they are the unknown ones.
Right. But let me throw a hypothetical at you. The Bush family, there's been a lot of talk that because the Bush family have been members of the Skull and Crossbones or whatever it's called at Yale.
Skull and Bones out of Yale.
Yeah, Skull and Bones and that club out on the West Coast that they, Henry
Kissinger. That's the Bohemian Grove.
Bohemian Lodge, right. The Bohemian Grove. That that they're part of an elite that's working with the Illuminati or whatever to bring us to our knees. But if this country went to its knees, the Bush family would suffer. Most of their money's not invested in China or India, which are the two coming countries of the next 50 years. It's invested, I would imagine, in the United States. So what what would it, why would it benefit the aristocracy of the United States? And I agree with you. There's an aristocracy we don't get to see. They live in homes that are a mile off the highway.
Do you really think, Howard, standing presidents have the kind of power and authority that the voters think they have?
I think that to, you know, there's an old saying in politics, and that is to lead the parade, figure out which direction it's going, then run to the head. So I think that to a large extent, leaders have to... they have to spend years skillfully cultivating PR, public relations, mm-hmm. skillfully cultivating headlines so they can go get the masses going in a certain direction. And once the rest of us are going in a certain direction, then they can run to the head of the pack and pretend to be the leader.
I think they're the puppets or the puppet masters.
It could easily be, but I think that the people who control things. Now, remember, you know, I spent 20 years in my field work of mass behavior as a publicist. You know that.
Yep.
And or at least 15 years of it. And so I tend to think that he who controls the publicity controls everything. It's like this oil crisis. The reason, again, those 15 years in publicity were very handy because there was a staccato pattern to the way headlines were emerging that indicated that there was a publicity brain behind it. If you can change the way we all perceive things, there's an old Bloom saying, and it's new ways of seeing lead to new ways of being. Well, now, I meant that phrase as a positive thing. The more you can open your eyes to things and the more you can have insight, the more you can better the way things are. But there's also, well, with every positive thing, there's always a dark side. It can always be used for good or for evil. And in this case, perceptions can be used either to create blazingly new, astonishingly new ways of life, or they can be used to put us in a little prison and not let us and keep us deceived about whether we're imprisoned or not.
Let's go next, east of the Rockies. You're out coast to coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, first of all, a very happy birthday to you, George.
Well, thank you, sir.
And I wanted to ask, you know, first of all, I'm 48 years old. I don't advocate drug use. I think it's wrong. I think it's bad for people. However, going back in history, you know, it used to be patriotic to grow hemp.
Right.
And from a scientific standpoint, obviously, you know, the research has been done. They've shown that hemp will grow virtually anywhere without any fertilizers, that it is, you know, twice as efficient in converting sunlight into potential energy in the plant. Why there isn't more research being done into using hemp as a biofuel in terms of a diesel-type biofuel? You know, because Henry Ford even developed a car that ran on hemp seed oil back
right.
in the 1920s. And I wonder why, you know, the United States is so loath to even research that. I want to get your feedback on that, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
George, you have an idea on that one?
We had a guy in Missouri who used to drive around in what was called a hemp mobile. He
right.
was able to make it for $3 a gallon, and 7-8 years ago, that seemed outrageous. Now it seems like the bargain of the century.
Yes, exactly. My feeling is that it's a long tradition, and actually goes back. I was thinking of it back to the 1840s. In the 1840s and the 1850s, a lot of Germans came into the United States, and they came in with a beer-drinking culture. The Protestants in America were not a beer-drinking culture. So they came down very hard on beer. And then, of course, we had a ban on alcoholic beverages altogether at the beginning of the 20th century. One subculture likes to take another subculture's pleasures and yank it away. And that's what happened with Prohibition, for example. Now the question is there something really wrong with smoking marijuana? Well, I don't smoke marijuana. I probably smoked my last marijuana in 1971. That's by now a long, long, long time ago. And don't use any drugs whatsoever. But is marijuana actually harmful to people? Well, I've had friends in the music business and was very distressed, George, by the amount of marijuana they smoked. I was really upset about it. But the fact is, it didn't kill them, and they did very well in their business.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, even though I don't care for it, it's not any more harmful. Well, actually, alcohol, there are a lot of figures that indicate that alcohol can be very damaging in all kinds of ways. Not only can it screw up your body, but it can screw up your relationships, and it causes little things like automobile accidents in which you can kill other human beings.
I said last night we should do away with the income tax, go to a sales use tax and legalize drugs, not because I support it,
right,
but because we can't stop it, we can't stop the war on it, and all the money that's going to flow into this country will be taxed through sales tax, because you know they buy boats and, you know, these Armani suits and everything else, and we might as well do it that way. I think crime will plummet if drugs were legal in this country and controlled.
And here's one thing that indicates that you're probably right. Now, remember, I don't like drug use. I don't like it at all. Those
Either
friends of mine, I did have friends in the music industry who killed themselves.
But people who use drugs are going to find them and use them.
Well, there's a city called Amsterdam, and everybody knows about Amsterdam by now. Amsterdam legalized drugs about 20 years ago. Has Amsterdam gone down the tubes? Has it become a city of sloth? Have people in Amsterdam become lazy? Do they waste their powers? No, Amsterdam's one of the most productive cities in the world.
And what's the crime like there?
And the crime is not high unless you happen to be Theo van Gogh and somebody disembowels you because he doesn't like your religious points of view. So the crime rate is low. It has not done anything, so far as I can see, to either increase or decrease it. And hemp turns out to be something you can use for all kinds of stuff.
I think it's dramatic. I think most people who are in jail are there on petty drug charges. And, you know, we need to control this. And we're not going to do it the way we're doing. There's too much illicit traffic. There's too much money being used and spent under the table. And I don't know. That would be my plan.
Well, I agree with you. But the most important thing we can do to help everybody in this country is produce the next great products and sell them to the rest of the world, so even the Chinese and the Indians have to come to us for these products. And there is a guy who's doing this kind of thing. His name, and I hate to promote him because he's a kind of a totalitarian tyrant as well, but his name is Steve Jobs. And you create more products like the iPhone.
He's a genius.
You create these things. And I saw my first Apple Air yesterday. And was a
That's the
you
skinny.
Create these things that make people's mouths water. And one of
that's
the
skinny computer, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, the really skinny one. And people, it's been shown. I mean, this is scientifically validated that if you create products that people's mouths water over, they will find a way to purchase them, and those products will be recession-proof. And those are the products that will bring a country out of recession and ultimately out of debt.
Mr. Bloom, once again, thank you for your insight.
George, you are a pleasure, and I adore you.
That's Howard Bloom. Now, when we come right back, Glenn Kimball joins us with some ancient mysteries on Coast to Coast AM.